Good afternoon. My name is Ludy, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to today's conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. And if you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Robin Jones, you may begin your conference.
Great. Thank you very much, and welcome everyone to the ADA Audio Conference Series, which is sponsored by the Great Lakes ADA Center in collaboration with the ADA National Network. We're happy that everybody was able to join us for today. This is our May session. Excuse me, my allergies are definitely getting the best of me these days. Before I introduce our speaker, just a few notes about today's session. So we do have people who are joining us today in a variety of different modes. We have individuals who are on the telephone. We also have individuals who are in the webinar platform listening to us. You will be able to ask, as you saw in the instructions, questions different ways. One will be to submit your question in the chat area. And thank you very much for those individuals who submitted your questions early. As you would have seen, we did provide an opportunity for people to submit questions in advance, and we did get some, and we will be going through those prior to opening it up for your individual questions today. We also have closed captioning, which is available in the webinar platform as well. So we will be switching back and forth between the platform and the telephone for those of you that are on the telephone and want to ask your questions. So again, thank you very much for joining us today. And I would like to introduce our speaker. We're very happy today to have with us Jean Goldberg, who is the Senior Attorney Advisor in the Office of Legal Counsel within the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. For those of you who have been with us for a number of years, as this program is approximately 20 years old now that we've had the ADA Audio Conference Series, Jean has joined us in the past and has been a speaker for us in the past and has been well received, and we're very happy that she was able to join us again today. Her full bio was posted on the website, so I won't take a lot of time to go through and read that. If you want to refresh yourselves again, you can go back to the website to do that. Just a reminder that today's session is being recorded, and it will be available at the conclusion or shortly after the conclusion of the session for those that may have to leave or missed it and would like to review that information. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and turn the microphone over to Jean, who's just going to give us a little bit of update in regards to what's happening with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission before we launch into the questions that you all might have. So go ahead, Jean.
Thanks so much, Robin, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon. As Robin said, we're going to go through the questions that were asked in advance as well as any that you write in during the session. I'm going to start out with a quick overview of developments here at the EEOC. The first is that I wanted to mention, and we've posted this on the webinar website this afternoon, there is an updated version of a list some of you may have seen before of all of EEOC's ADA enforcement guidance and technical assistance publications, as well as those under GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. So you can turn to that list. It's 7 or 8 pages. It has all the titles as well as the hyperlinks, so you can click to go directly to that publication on our website if it looks to be of interest. You should feel free to use these publications not only to consult on a day-to-day basis for answers, but also for those of you in HR or other capacities where you might produce trainings, internal or external, or do your own newsletters or bulletins, or other publications, feel free to lift from any of these documents. There's no copyright. Reproduction is encouraged. So please borrow from these however you wish if you think they could be helpful in your compliance efforts. It's, of course, been a year of transition between administrations, but not quite yet at EEOC. We have 3 commissioners and 2 vacancies, and we are currently under the leadership of the acting chair who was appointed by President Trump, Vicki Lipnick, who has been on the commission for close to 10 years. and we are awaiting confirmation by the Senate of the two nominated commissioners, as well as the renomination of Commissioner Feldblum and the nomination of a general counsel. But none of that means that we're in a holding pattern, since everything has proceeded apace, even as we await our complete leadership change. So I think I can give you a good sense of our activities and the ADA issues that we're seeing in charge investigations, kinds of cases that are coming up in litigation. Just as a quick overview, as many of you no doubt know, on a regulatory note, EEOC issued a new regulation under Section 501 of the Rehabilitation Act, which applies only to federal government agencies, although it's largely the equivalent of Title I of the ADA that applies to private employers and state and local government employers. So this new rule for federal agencies recently took effect, and it deals exclusively with issues of affirmative action. For private employers, affirmative action based on disability has always been permitted but never required. By contrast, federal government agencies are obligated under Section 501 of the Rehab Act to be model employers, and they've long been under an instruction to engage in affirmative action. What this new regulation actually does is to set out workforce goals in the regulation for the federal government's hiring of people with disabilities. Goals of 12% individuals with disabilities in an agency's workforce, and 2% of those people with targeted disabilities. So those are, in other words, more severe historic disabilities that historically have barred people from employment. And these goals are much higher and more forceful than the goals that were adopted for federal contractors a few years back by Department of Labor. And there are a number of different ways that agencies can achieve these hiring goals, special hiring authorities, including so-called Schedule A and the OPM regulations, and special hiring for authorities for veterans. And totally new in this space, the regulation requires that federal agencies provide certain personal assistance services as affirmative action for people with targeted disabilities who might need that kind of assistance in order to be employed. And that's something that's never required as reasonable accommodation by employers, but it's a special new obligation as affirmative action by federal agencies to provide those kinds of personal assistance services, such as assistance with eating or toileting or removing outerwear or exiting a vehicle. To enable somebody with a targeted disability to be employed. So on that publication list, you'll see if you are with a federal agency and are interested in this and don't have materials yet, the question and answer guides on the new Section 501 rule and a special question and answer guide on federal agencies' obligations to provide personal assistance services and tips, a separate tip sheet for applicants with disabilities who are applying for federal government jobs. As far as our enforcement, I can say that in fiscal year 2017, we received almost 32% of our charges had ADA claims in them. So over 80,000 discrimination charges that EEOC received under all the statutes we enforce, about 26,000 had ADA claims. So that's very high. It's only surpassed by race and retaliation. These kinds of claims involved all types of impairments, but the highest number were issues involving orthopedic impairments and also various mental impairments. Anxiety, depression, PTSD, bipolar, if you put all those together, it was about 20% of the charges. Interestingly, the PTSD charges have doubled since about 2010, so we don't quite know why that is or to what extent it might be related to different factors, including potentially returning vets entering the workforce, but it's interesting to see that trend in the charges, and it may be something worth being alert to in training and advice. On the publication list, you'll see a new publication we've issued called Depression, PTSD, and Other Mental Health Conditions in the Workplace, and also a publication called Mental Health Provider's Role in a Client's Request for Reasonable Accommodation at Work, something that's geared toward the doctor who's giving the employer supporting medical information to try to make it helpful for the employer. And there's also an enforcement guidance on psychiatric disabilities and several publications on vets and the ADA. In terms of our litigation program, about over 40% of the suits that EEOC filed under the statutes we enforce in FY 2017 were ADA suits. So that tells you there is some compliance work still to do. As far as the systemic cases that we filed, in other words, ones that involved an employer practice or policy, there were five policies or, you know, practices that were at issue in all of those cases that involved a systemic issue. And I'll just tick off what those are because I think they're sort of red flags. If you encounter them, that's a potential ADA issue. Situations where, or a GINA issue. The first is a GINA issue where a employer in their post-offer or fitness for duty exams has their doctor, the employer's doctor, asking about family medical history. That violates GINA. In pre-offer medical questionnaires or pre-offer interview questions, employers asking about applicants' medical conditions. That violates the ADA. Next, employers automatically rescinding offers to applicants if the employer learns in the post-offer exam that they have particular impairments or a history of a workers' comp claim without doing that required individualized assessment of this applicant's present ability and whether they presently can do the job or pose a safety risk, rather than just basing the decision, in other words, on their past medical history. And also situations where employers are requiring employees returning from medical leave to be completely free of any restrictions and not in need of accommodation, that kind of so-called 100% healed policy violates the ADA. And finally, situations where employers have been automatically firing someone who requires disability-related leave in excess of 12 weeks, even if the person, the amount of extra leave the person needs would not pose an undue hardship. So so-called no-fault leave policies based on 12 weeks or some other period of time. So that gives you a quick overview of the big issues we're seeing. A lot of the other cases that come to EEOC seem to be quite straightforward individual situations, and you can get a flavor for those by looking on our website, www.eoc.gov, on the homepage, click on Newsroom, and you'll see a press release for each time EEOC files a case or resolves one, so you can get a good flavor for what are the kinds of issues that are coming to us. And many of them are really garden variety compliance issues that boil down to making sure, I think, that even if frontline managers and supervisors, of course, can't be familiar with all the details in the law, that they know how to spot when they should get some advice to phone home, in other words. Robin, do you want to start out with what the questions are that we got in advance?
Sure, that would be great, Jean. And given your discussion here about some of these topics with this guidance and things, I'll start with a set of questions that was asked specifically around the issue of when someone is requesting accommodations, are they required to meet with the employer's physician and or is an employer able to ask for a second medical opinion?
Oh, okay. These are good questions. Let me first state the basic rule about medical information in support of an accommodation request. Employers can ask for medical information in support of the accommodation request if either the disability or the need for the accommodation is not obvious or already known. So an employer is entitled to satisfy itself that the employee has an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity and that they medically need what they're asking for. Those can be two separate things. Typically, the employer goes about this in either of two ways. First, either by asking the employee to go get from their treating physician the supporting information that's needed and telling the employee, we want to know your diagnosis, your limitations, what accommodations are needed, how long you're expected to need this accommodation. Have your doctor write that up and send us a letter or bring us some kind of supporting information. Alternatively, the employer could ask the employee to sign a release, a limited release, allowing the employer to contact the employee's doctor directly to ask these questions, to get the information and the medical information in support of the accommodation request. And there's no limit on follow-up to get missing information, to clarify whatever the doctor's provided that is not clear, to ask if an alternative accommodation that the employer might prefer would meet the employee's medical restrictions, to ask the doctor about that. A lot of employers are familiar with under the FMLA, the Family and Medical Leave Act, enforced by Department of Labor, that there's a very strict protocol in terms of the form that you give the employee and the second opinion, and it's very prescribed. But there's no micromanaging by the ADA, similarly, of how the employer can get this supporting information. As long as it's not obvious or already known, the employer is allowed to get reasonable supporting medical information. So this first question you ask, which is really, I guess, from the employee perspective, when you're requesting accommodation, are you required to meet with the employer's physician? The ADA does not prevent an employer from requiring the employee to go see a doctor who the employer has chosen. So this comes up, for example, if the employee provides insufficient documentation from their treating physician to substantiate that they have an ADA disability or they need accommodation. It might be insufficient because it does not specify the existence of a disability or explain the need for accommodation. Maybe the employer thinks this treating physician is not really the professional with the relevant expertise to give me an opinion about this employee's medical condition. They're a doctor in a whole different area. Maybe the information doesn't specify the functional limitations the person has that relate to the accommodation request, or even in some situations, the employer might suspect that the information provided is not credible. So really the best way for the employer to proceed in that situation, I think, is before resorting to sending the employee to their own chosen doctor, the employer should probably explain why the documentation is insufficient and allow the employee or their doctor a chance to provide the missing information in a timely manner, to fill in the gaps, to clarify, then, if, you know, it's still insufficient, of course, the employer could, if they choose to, at their own expense, seek out the medical opinion of their own chosen doctor, and that could include telling the employee to go for an exam with the employer's chosen physician. The probably best practice is for the employer to make sure that if their doctor reaches a different conclusion, that they circle back with the employee's treating physician to make sure they were operating on the same set of facts and that there isn't anything they missed, and to determine whether there's any basis for reconciling their two different opinions. But if an employee refused to submit to the medical exam by the employer's chosen physician, where the employer's in a situation where they're allowed to do that follow-up, the employee would not be entitled to the accommodation because they failed to engage in that interactive process. So it is a tool that an employer can use in some situations to get that exam of the employee by their own chosen physician and add that information into the mix as they make their decision. The other question you asked, Robin, was really, I guess, from the employer perspective, which is under the ADA. You said, are you able to ask for a second medical opinion? The employer can do that at their expense. So in other words, you know, as I was saying, if the employer doubts the correctness of the employee's treating physician's conclusions and recommendations, the employer can pay for the employee to go for a second opinion at the doctor of the employer's own choosing. Just as I said before, as a practical matter, have you tried to clarify first with the treating physician what information you think you're missing or otherwise to satisfy yourself using the treating physician? And if that second doctor, your own doctor that the employer sends the employee to, reaches a different conclusion, you probably should ask them to circle back to the treating physician to discuss it, to make sure nothing was overlooked. Also, you want to make sure that as the employer, if you're sending an employee's records or the employee themselves to your chosen physician for an exam, that you're making sure your doctor, your chosen doctor, has all the relevant information. If you resort to just sending the employee to your own chosen physician for an exam with no records from the treating physician, with no opinion or information from the treating physician, with no other necessary information and specific questions that you have, I think the opinion is not going to be worth very much because the doctor isn't going to have what they need as a basis to give you their view. Robin?
Yep, great. Thank you. So kind of in the same vein here, at least in the context of employer questions and things of that nature, this is a FMLA and leave-related question, not specifically FMLA, but more of a comparison type of a thing. So how do you determine how much time to give an employee leave if they request it under the ADA, and what if they have already used up, I'm assuming meaning that they've used their 120 days of FMLA time up at that point, how does that factor into it? That's what this person's asking.
Okay, so sometimes the employee either is not eligible for FMLA because they have not been employed at least a year, or the employer doesn't have at least 50 employees, or the employee is covered by the FMLA, but they've used up their 12 weeks for the calendar year, and they or their doctor on their behalf say to the employer, she needs more time. She needs 6 more weeks. She needs 2 more months. Even though she's had the 12 weeks off, she needs some additional time for treatment or recuperation from these disability-related limitations. So the question for the employer is whether that additional time that's requested would pose an undue hardship. When considering that leave request, though, that request by the employee for additional time on top of FMLA under the ADA as an accommodation, the employer is allowed to consider all the time that was taken off. In other words, the 12 weeks under the FMLA, let's say, plus the 2 additional months sought under the ADA, whether all of that time together would pose an undue hardship on the employer's business, a significant difficulty or expense. I should mention that there are a couple of circuits, most notably a recent decision from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, where the court ruled that ADA does not require multi-month leave as a reasonable accommodation, that is just what FMLA is for, and that you might be able to get, some days or weeks under ADA, but that would be the limit. The EEOC and most courts disagree with that and have analyzed these requests for additional time after FMLA has expired under the undue hardship standard. So if the doctor can say the person will be able to return, even if they can only give an approximate date or range of dates, then the question for the employer is whether granting that additional leave requested would pose an undue hardship. And there's no set time, no set amount of extra time you need to give the employee off, because the answer is different in every case. An example that comes to mind is 2 cases from recent years involving nurses in hospitals. both of whom needed unscheduled leave as an accommodation when symptoms of their disability flared up. And in one case out of California, the nurse worked in the NICU in the hospital, running very specialized machines and equipment that she had to have a lot of training to do. And the court said it would be an undue hardship for her to be out on an unscheduled basis because they couldn't just readily get somebody else on short notice to fill in who had those that training, and not only that background, but also the training on the specific equipment and working in the NICU. In the other case, the nurse who also needed unscheduled leave periodically due to flare-up of disability-related symptoms, it was held not to be an undue hardship to grant that because looking at the facts of the particular case, the employer had a large roster of nurses, more than were scheduled to work at any given time, and when anyone called in for any reason that they couldn't make it, they had other folks on other shifts who they would, who weren't on that days or week shifts who they could go to. They also had a temporary service that they often called on that sent nurses. It didn't require training that those temporaries couldn't do to perform the job. They could fold in. So since the employer had the demonstrated capacity to absorb that intermittent absence for a variety of purposes, it was not an undue hardship to grant it to that particular, the leave on an unscheduled basis to that type, that particular nurse. So it gives you a flavor of the way in which EEOC and the courts look at the particular workplace, the staffing, the impact on the work, the training and qualifications necessary for the job, how you would handle the absence to determine whether it is an undue hardship in a given case to give that employee the additional amount of time that they need, whether it's a block of leave, so it's the length of leave sought, would that be an undue hardship, or whether it's the frequency or unpredictability of intermittent leave. You look at whether it would be an undue hardship under the ADA, and that's very different than under the FMLA, which is enforced by Department of Labor, which gives, if the person meets the qualifications, this sort of automatic right to 12 weeks of leave for the employee's own serious health condition or to care for a family member with a serious health condition. And there's no undue hardship defense that comes into play under the FMLA, just a list of certain requirements and certification that are needed. And I will mention one more thing, which is on the list of publications that Robin has on the conference website. We have, and you'll see it on page 3, a publication issued just about 2 years ago called Employer-Provided Leave and the ADA. And it goes through all these different examples of what might be an undue hardship or not based on the facts, just to give you more to look at, and goes through all the factors, but also some specific examples. Robin?
Great, thank you. And in that vein, since we were mentioning or doing some contrast there with FMLA, we did have another question that has some relationship to that, and that is, can you talk about whether or not a employee would be able to use ADA leave or FMLA leave for a child's disability accommodation?
Oh, that's a good question. No, you would not. The ADA only provides for accommodation of the applicant or employee's own disability. The ADA does prohibit discrimination based on association with a person with a disability, but that associational discrimination under the ADA is limited to where I might, for example, treat someone differently as an employer because of their association with a family member, for example, with a disability. An employer can't, based on stereotypes or assumptions about caregiving responsibilities, refuse to hire, for example, or refuse to promote an individual with a family member with a disability. That would be discrimination based on association with a person with a disability. The employer can certainly tell the individual or have whatever requirements they have for the position or the promotion, and you have to work 8 million hours a week and do all this travel, and those can be the requirements of the job, and not hire somebody who, for whatever reason, caregiving or otherwise, says that they are unable to do that. However, the employer cannot assume, based on a stereotype about a person with a disability or caregiving responsibilities related to a person with a disability, that someone would not be qualified for the job based on that association. But there's no requirement under the ADA to provide reasonable accommodation to an employee to allow them to care for a family member or other person with a disability. In other words, that accommodation provision does not apply to association with a person with a disability. The ADA association provision is limited to prohibiting the type of disparate treatment that I mentioned or harassment of a person based on their association with someone with a disability. But there is no accommodation under the ADA, accommodation right under the ADA, for an employee to get leave or any other accommodation to care for a family member with a disability. And if you want to read more about what the association provision does allow, and these limits, how it does not apply to provide accommodation, on page 5 of the publication list, you'll see a Q&A on association provision of the ADA. Robin?
Great. Thank you, Jean. Kind of staying in the same vein here with some of the questions, can you address the issue of what documentation employers may require when someone's returning after being out on leave? So we're kind of on this leave theme here. So what kind of documentation can an employee can an employer require that an employee bring? And can they require a fitness for duty exam, or is documentation from the employee's doctor sufficient?
Okay. Yes, when an employee is returning from leave, the employer can ask them medical questions, in other words, make disability-related inquiries, or require a medical exam if the employer has a reasonable belief that the employee's present current ability to perform the job is impaired by a medical condition, or that he'll pose a direct threat to safety due to a medical condition. So the question is whether the nature of the leave that was taken, what the employer already knows about the condition for which the leave was taken, the nature of the treatment during the leave, what they already know would give them a reason to believe that even though the person has been cleared to return to work by their doctor, that they may, in fact, due to a medical condition, not be able to perform their job functions or pose a direct threat to safety. Does the employer have a reasonable belief for questioning that and therefore for seeking follow-up fitness for duty information? So this could arise either because the employee calls up and says, I'm ready to come back, or the employee submits something from their doctor, but it's just very conclusory and says they're free to come back. They're fit to come back. And the question for the employer who wants to get follow-up medical information in response to that to satisfy themselves the person's able to come back is, do you have a reasonable belief, given the nature of the absence, that their present ability to perform their job or do so safely is compromised? So if you look in the inquiries and exams guidance, it's also on the list, policy guidance on making disability-related inquiries or medical exams of current employees. It's on page 4. question seven, I think it is, goes through some examples. The first is, I think these are sort of helpful to view it on a spectrum of possible fact patterns that might come up. The first is involves a data entry clerk. She broke her leg while skiing. She was out for 4 weeks. She returns to work on crutches. There's no reason in that situation why the employer would seek medical information. They don't have a belief based on objective evidence either that her ability to type and do her other essential functions or do it safely would be impaired by medical condition. She's back at her desk. She just is on crutches due to the broken leg. But there's no basis for asking her for follow-up medical information about her fitness for duty, if that's those are the only facts. By contrast, there's an example there where the employer knows the person was a person was out on leave because he was having difficulty with his psychiatric medication. It had to be recalibrated. He had made threats to several coworkers and was disciplined. Then he has his 6-week hospitalization for treatment. He's released to return to work by his doctor, who sends a very cursory note simply saying cleared to return to work. In that situation, by contrast to the typist with the broken leg, based on what precipitated the leave and what the employer knew about the nature of the treatment that the person was off for, the employer has a reasonable belief based on objective evidence that the person might pose a direct threat due to the medical condition, and it can ask the employee for additional documentation about their treatment or medication to know that they are qualified, that they're able to perform their essential functions and don't form a direct threat. So it might be questions about the medication or treatment or requests that he submit to a medical exam before being cleared to return to work. So those are just two of the examples that you can find in that guidance on that question about when can an employer, should an employer seek, when may an employer seek supporting medical information that somebody's fit for duty and when they're returning after a leave of absence. Robin?
Great. Thank you. Complicated issues sometimes. So here's a question on definition of disability. What is considered a disability under the ADA? Would migraines, fibromyalgia, obesity, infertility, would all of these now be considered disabilities following the ADA Amendments Act?
Oh, well, that's a good question. The ADA Amendments Act obviously made these changes to the definition of disability, making it much easier for many impairments to meet the definition of what's an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. But there's still no set list of medical conditions that are automatically covered or not. Congress chose to keep the legal standard to be that you look at each person and their physical or mental impairment, and whether for that person the impairment substantially limits a major life activity. And they made all these changes to the standard to make it much more likely that someone would be covered. They expanded major life activities to include major bodily functions. So, for example, diabetes substantially limits function of the endocrine system, one would think. You look at somebody without the benefit of any medication or other mitigating measures they might use. You look at the underlying impairment. Is that substantially limiting? And if the impairment is episodic, it comes, flares up and remits, or it's in remission, you look at whether it's substantially limiting when active. So all these changes make it much more likely something would be a disability, but that doesn't mean that everything is covered, and there is still no set list you can consult of medical conditions that are in or out. As far as the specific ones you asked about, obesity is actually a hotly contested issue in the case law as to whether or when that's covered as a disability. EEOC has taken the position that morbid obesity, which is a medical diagnosis, is a physical impairment. And then they apply the standards to see if that person's morbid obesity substantially limits them in their circulatory function or other major bodily functions, major life activities. There are a number of courts that have held, however, that obesity, including even the medical diagnosis of morbid obesity, is not a disability. So it's something that, as I said, is hotly contested in the case law. As far as infertility, in and of itself, I'd say that's similarly quite contentious. It's certainly what we would look to see if there is an impairment. It's certainly easier to show disability coverage if the infertility is a symptom, a side effect, a result of some other impairment. And that may be the easiest case. Otherwise, I think the court decisions are all over the map about that. The others you mentioned, migraines and fibromyalgia, I think those are much less controversial. There are plenty of cases post-ADA Amendments Act finding that those meet the definition in a given case. For example, migraines, that's an episodic impairment. When the person is having a migraine, you'd ask, are they substantially limited in a major life activity without the benefit of any medication? You can see how that would be much easier to meet the standard. EOC's regulations have a bunch of examples of conditions that they think will virtually always meet the standard. A lot of conditions like blindness, deafness, missing limbs, bipolar, PTSD, but also they give examples of things that may or may not, given the facts, meet the definition, and you look at how long the limitations are supposed to last and what they are and how limited the person is. There's an example in the EEOC's amended ADA regulations of a back impairment that is going to cause a 20-pound lifting restriction that's lasting several months or expected to last for several months, and that would be a substantial an impairment that substantially limits lifting. So even that could be a disability. No longer does a condition, medical condition, have to be permanent or long-term to meet this standard. And, you know, in real time as an employer, if it's not obvious, you may want to verify through requested medical documentation that the person has that diagnosis, what their limitations are, what accommodations they need. You may have back and forth with the doctor to see if alternative accommodations that you're interested in providing in lieu of what was requested, whether those would meet the fit the bill, whether those would meet the person's restrictions. You're just not going to, you know, demand the same kind of extensive analysis of medical records that might have been involved pre-ADA Amendments Act, but rather get to the main points. There certainly are examples in the case law of things not covered even by the expanded definition of disability, cases involving sprains and torn ACLs and H1N1 flu. And there's also, I have to say, in case there's any litigators on the phone, that there have been quite a number of cases where the plaintiff's lawyer has simply failed to put in the evidence in the lawsuit, failed to put that evidence into the record about the person's disability, just simply assuming incorrectly that by virtue of the ADA Amendments Act being enacted, that would be it, and the person would always be covered, but that's certainly not the case. And when it comes to litigation, the plaintiff has to put in that evidence, and those requirements to do that haven't been eliminated by the ADA Amendments Act. But none of the rules for an employer's ability to verify somebody's really got this condition and that it's limiting enough that they need an accommodation, none of those rules have been changed by the ADA Amendments Act. So the employer can still go through that interactive process, even though it's going to be with a lighter touch. Robin?
Thank you. That definition question is just that's a tough one. People continue to struggle with that here and there. So, So here's a question that I've avoided, but it's an inevitable one, and it relates to the issue of service animals and emotional support animals. So as we know, Department of Justice, in their 2010 ADA standards, regulation revisions for Title II and Title III, defined a service animal very specifically. However, Title I does not have a similar definition or doesn't have any definition specifically under Title I. So the question here is, does Title I allow for emotional support animals in the workplace as opposed to service animals or vice versa? And in related to that, can you just, you know, in general, just talk about how they're defined in general, service versus emotional support, and how they'd be treated under Title I? And if it was an accommodation, can employers place specific restrictions, things like specific breeds, like no pit bull mix or pit bull, et cetera, in that regard? So kind of a complicated question, but
okay.
that whole sure. issue of service animal, emotional support animal, when, how, what, and, you know, what are
yeah.
any restrictions on employers?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. As you say, the Department of Justice in the prior administration addressed in their Title II and Title III regulations at a very granular level what the definition of a service animal is, and specifically limiting it to dogs and miniature horses, and that it has to be trained to perform a specific task. On the other hand, it's always been the case under Title II and Title III that the DOJ has said there are very strict rules about the limited amount of information that the, for example, public accommodation owner can ask for or get, limited amount of documentation and so on, to admit the individual with the service animal into their place of business. And so maybe because it's a one-off type of transaction, when you're seeking to go into a store or a hotel or a movie theater, they've put much greater limits on what the business owner can demand in terms of any type of documentation, but have given guidance about, you know, these basic questions. On the other hand, they've really gotten into a lot of detail about what constitutes a service animal, and have this very now much more restricted definition. EEOC has never addressed those same questions as a separate freestanding issue as to service animals in our regulations or in decisions that have been issued, administrative decisions. So what happens for employers before EEOC is simply that request to bring a service animal into a workplace is effectively a request for an exception to a policy, like any other accommodation request, right? You're asking for an exception to the no animals in the workplace, in the building rule, and if there is such a rule. And it's treated like any other accommodation request. It's a request for an exception to the no animals rule, and the employer is free to proceed just like with any other accommodation request. So if the disability or the medical need for the accommodation for having the animal is not obvious or already known, the employer can ask for supporting medical information through this interactive process to determine that person has a substantially limiting impairment, they medically need the animal. You could determine, you know, what the diagnosis is, why the animal's needed, whether or not it's disruptive in any way. So a lot more information, I suppose, that an employer is entitled to get through under Title I through the interactive process, because these requests are treated simply like any other accommodation request. So a lot more information than maybe a business owner might be allowed to obtain under Title III, where it's just a one-off transaction of somebody coming into your store, for example. So we have not seen a lot of these charges typically we're still, you know, just really getting the most classic type of somebody who's blind wanting to bring their dog into the workplace, like really straightforward questions, not charges involving the unusual or exotic animals that have featured in a lot of stories recently about airplane travel and the rest. So we just aren't seeing those. I don't know whether it's because there are a lot of state and local laws now that have discrimination provisions regarding comfort animals, and so it may be that if someone has an issue with one of those, they're bringing their claim to the local or state human rights commission under that local law. But as far as EEOC is concerned, as far as Title I of the ADA is concerned, we don't have any guidance that makes a distinction in terms of what whether the animal is a trained to perform a task that relates to emotional comfort or a different type of task. We just don't have anything addressing a distinction between emotional support animals as opposed to so-called service animals as defined under the DOJ reg. So we would treat all of it the same, barring any, you know, guidance to the contrary, as an accommodation request. And it may be that in some of the cases involving emotional support animals that the interactive process, it will result in the employer learning that there is not a medical diagnosis or there is not a medical need for the accommodation requested of having the animal present. And that's going to result in a denial of accommodation, just like it would with any other thing that's requested that isn't where those things can't be established, the disability and the need for accommodation. So the employer has a lot more latitude under Title I to ask for that information and to satisfy themselves. Beyond those threshold issues of does this person have a disability, do they medically need to have the animal present in the workplace, there are obviously issues of undue hardship, as with any other accommodation request. So the employer would certainly be allowed to satisfy themselves that the animal is not going to be disruptive. The employer might be getting documentation in some situations from the animal trainer or other way that the employee is going to offer to demonstrate how the animal's ability to behave properly in the workplace and not pose an undue hardship due to any disruption, any safety issues, not being under control of the employee, and so on. There's a great publication on the Job Accommodation Network website, askjan.org, askjan.org, called Service Animals in the Workplace, that discusses both the, you know, recognizing that a lot of people have this question that you posed because of the very specific DOJ rules, kind of pulls together from both the employer and the employee perspective what this interactive process might look like and the grounds on which an employer might grant or deny a request to bring a service animal into the workplace. So I'd really commend it to you. It's called Service Animals in the Workplace, and if you go on askjan.org and just type service animals into the search box, it'll come up as one of the first hits. Robin, was there more about that you wanted me to address?
No, I think that the only thing, again, I think you clarified the question about specific breeds and things of that nature. That might be part of their undue hardship or other considerations. Would that be correct?
I think so. I think, you know, because the employer is entitled to satisfy themselves that no undue hardship is posed, if there was any concern about the particular animal, I mean, you, in other words, the employer would be entitled to satisfy itself that this particular animal, whatever animal it is, that the employee is seeking to have present in the workplace as an accommodation, that it's appropriately trained and that it does not pose an undue hardship. So, you know, that could be based on any number of considerations. There is also a lot of discussion I have heard employers raise about the option of having a trial period, and that is certainly permissible with any type of accommodation, and you know, where you would allow the employee in this situation to bring the service animal in on a trial basis and see if allowing the animal is effective and if it does not pose an undue hardship. And, you know, there's no set time frame for doing that, but you could do it for 1 week, you could do it for 4 weeks or 6 weeks, enough time to assess the situation. But that's always an option, too, if there is a question that you can't really resolve through the cold information in the interactive process that you obtain about whether this would be disruptive or not and whether the animal would behave appropriately.
Great. Thank you. And I did enter that website and the name of the fact sheet into the webinar platform, so folks can look for it there as well.
Oh, great.
But thank you very much for that information. So we'll switch gears a little bit here. And here's a question that are unpaid workers, such as volunteers or student interns, covered by Title I? For example, we have many medical professional students who come to do internships of 3 to 6 months or more with us. They are, quote unquote, unpaid positions, but they are working and doing the same things as paid employees under supervision. If they require accommodations, do we dress them as an employee, or are there other obligations?
Well, that's a great question. For unpaid or volunteer interns, usually coverage, whether somebody is covered as an employee under the EEO, federal EEO laws, turns on whether, even though they're unpaid, they receive some kind of significant remuneration in some form. Could be a pension, could be life insurance, could be workers' comp, it could be access to professional certifications, and that may feature that last one in determining that a medical intern might be characterized as an employee under the law, even though they are not paid. So, you know, for example, you could have situations where an educational institution provides a lot of significant benefits to an unpaid intern for their volunteer work, and then they qualify as an employee of that employer. There are also situations where, even though the person is unpaid, and even though we know that volunteers and interns, as a general matter, are not covered, those people, unpaid folks, are considered employees because their volunteer work is required as a prerequisite to getting regular employment. It regularly leads to paid employment with the same employer. A good example is police and firefighter academies or other training programs that you go through, and then you know, it's a prerequisite. It's an apprenticeship or training program that leads to necessarily is a prerequisite for the employment. So that's what we look at. I guess bottom line with these medical interns and medical students, although I honestly, there are cases going both ways, as a practical matter, you may have an obligation to accommodate either way, because if the person is still a student, then you may have an obligation, you know, as a college or university hospital, for example, obligations under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act or Title II of the ADA toward those medical students. And then if the individual is considered an employee, an obligation under Title I of the ADA. So there have been some very interesting cases that have actually come up lately, one against Johns Hopkins University, where they had a deaf nursing student. They did accommodate her with a sign language interpreter through the whole period of her education. She graduated, they hired her for a job, and at that point they wanted to stop providing the full-time sign language interpretation once she was hired, because they viewed their obligation to be different under Title I, and they lost that case. Applying the Title I standards, they had an obligation to her as an employee. There was a whole analysis of whether or not it would pose an undue hardship to provide the sign language interpretation. But I think this comes up a lot where the employer is, the institution is dealing with folks who are students, and they may or may not then become employees. And even if different laws come into play, you may have an obligation either way to accommodate. Robin, have you seen that situation?
Yeah, we do. We get quite a bit of this from the student side, and I think it's really important that there be an ongoing dialogue and discussion with the education institution that that student is coming from. And these are things that should be also discussed during the process of signing contracts and things of that nature to take students
right.
and interns and things as well. It's a very critical aspect of this process.
One thing I'll also add, though, that has come up with this is that the type of accommodation that a student might be entitled to in some respects may differ from what they're entitled to as an employee. And this may just be, as part of an interactive process, a matter of educating the individual who requests accommodation once they transition into an employment setting. Specifically, I'm thinking about the fact that in the education setting, sometimes accommodations allow for extra time to complete assignments, extra time for tests, fewer numbers of problems, or, in terms of, let's just take the example of a math test for younger students or a homework assignment, where students may have come all the way through and been used to getting certain types of accommodations that involved a fewer number of assignments or shorter assignments and or extra time to complete assignments or for tests. Those types of accommodations may not translate at all in the workplace, where, as we know, an employer never has to lower performance or production standards as an accommodation. In other words, an employer does not have to allow an employee to complete fewer reports or allow an employee extra time to complete their reports compared to what all employees in that job are permitted or required to do. So that may be an issue that comes up in the interactive process with the employer explaining to the individual what they are entitled to in the workplace, which may be different from what they were entitled to as accommodation in the school setting.
And different what they might be eligible for accommodation during in their internship, too, because if their internship is part of that education process and not employment, there may still be accommodations. So we sometimes will see altered work schedule, altered schedules and things of that nature that might be provided a student in an internship situation that might not be reasonable or may not fall into that same category.
Right.
As an employee. So, yeah. Great. Thank you. Okay.
Other questions?
Yep, we do have some more here, and then we'll open it up for thoughts. So I'll just remind people that are on the phone or on the webinar platform, if you want to start to submit your questions that you might have, you can use the chat room. We'll also be asking in a few minutes the operator to ask people on the phone if they want to queue in for questions as well. So we'll keep going here so we have some time. Here is a question that is, at what point can an employer terminate an employee with a disability who is not able to perform their job duties with or without an accommodation? Do we have to retain them until a position is available that they can be reassigned to if someone leaves or retires? What if there is no current position available?
Well, that's a really good question. No, an employer does not have to retain an employee who's not qualified to do their current job, and if there's no vacant position for which they're qualified to reassign them to. In that instance, the individual is going to be subject to, either termination or disability retirement application, if that's available, or short-term or long-term disability insurance, if the employer has that available. But they're not going to be entitled to remain employed with no position. What happens is the employer concludes there's no way to accommodate this individual in their current position. We've tried, we've looked, we can't. okay, we're going to look at whether there's a vacant position we can reassign them to. We don't have to create a position. We don't have to bump somebody from a position. And we don't have to promote the individual to a higher level position. So we're going to talk to the individual about what kind of work they're able and willing to do, what level they're willing to go down to if there's nothing available at their current salary level, if there are different geographic locations, where they're willing to relocate to, if at all. And then those are going to provide the parameters for the vacancy search. And employers should memorialize, you know, that, what the employee said about what they're willing to take and what they're able to do. And then you're going to look at whether there are any vacancies that fit those restrictions. And, you know, and that the employee is qualified for, that they can perform with their medical restrictions with an accommodation if need be. And that search for a vacancy need not take any particular amount of time. Sometimes it might take literally an afternoon or a few days or a week, but not more, because the employer has a limited number of vacancies, or they have access to this information on a centralized database and they're able to hone in pretty quickly. There are other situations where it may take longer because the person conducting the vacancy search, handling this accommodation request, needs to contact various supervisors of those vacancies to find out exactly what's entailed in the position, figure out if this person's medical restrictions could be accommodated in that position, and so on. So how long it takes varies, but they're based on your access to this information as the employer. But there's no set amount of time that you need to look. Once you have concluded that there is no vacancy presently to which you could reassign the individual, then that's the end of the interactive process and you've fulfilled your accommodation obligation. On the other hand, if you come up with several positions that they might be qualified for, you may pick the one and offer it to the individual, and they may or may not accept it. For example, if it's a lower salary, they may not want to, or if it involves moving, they may not want to. But by making that offer of a position that meets their medical restrictions as a reassignment, you have fulfilled your obligation. So there's no set amount of time. I think that sometimes folks think mistakenly there's a set amount of time, because the enforcement guidance on reasonable accommodation, when it talks about figuring out what's a vacancy, includes in vacancies positions that you're already advertising, and also positions that you know are going to become vacant in a short amount of time. For example, you've already gotten the notice that somebody is retiring in 4 weeks. Though that position could be considered a vacancy. But and maybe if that position fits the bill and it's about to become vacant, maybe this individual could be on a unpaid leave in the interim until you can reassign them into that position. But there, other than that reference to a position that you know is going to become vacant in a reasonably short period of time, there is no reference to a time period for which you've got to search for vacancies. It's not required under the ADA to be some ongoing process where you search for weeks or months. The amount of time it takes is really just a function of how long it takes the employer to assemble and assess this information. Robin?
Great, thank you. I'm glad that somebody asked this next question, because it's one of these things that I have, and you could probably, your colleagues could verify that I've asked a million times within the EOC and never happy with my responses that I get. So I'm glad somebody asked this. And the question is, what is the EOC doing about accessibility of web-based information that is used by most employers now for applying for a job, even within their own internal HR functions? Many employer websites are not accessible and prevent someone who uses assistive technology from having the same access to information as employees or applicants without disabilities. Asking for a paper application or contacting them about the inaccessibility sets up a red flag that you have a disability and then may not get the same treatment as other applicants. I've also worked for employers where I could not access their internal HR website to see my benefits, pay stubs, W-2s, et cetera, and had to work one-on-one with HR staff to get that information, which meant I couldn't do it from home or privately. Why is this not an employment issue, too?
Okay. Wow. All right. I'm going to take the second part first about internal systems that employees, a current employee needs to use, whether it's a supervisor certifying time and attendance records on, an inaccessible, a pay system that is inaccessible, won't work with their screen reader, or you mentioned benefits, other things that someone might do as an employee, and that the interface is not accessible. That is a Title I ADA accommodation issue, and the employee should notify HR that they need accommodation, and the accommodation might be accomplished by the employer either by an individualized workaround, if they do that sufficiently, or by making the actual system accessible. There's no one way they need to do that, but you should treat it as a request for accommodation where you run into that. If you're a federal government agency, everything that you procure has to be accessible under the standards under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, and every agency has its own complaint procedures for employees or members of the public to raise violations of Section 508, and lots of information about that made available by Department of Justice on section508.gov. I think the harder question that you've raised, Robin, is about online application systems. EEOC does have in its current strategic enforcement plan a priority listed of the enforcement priorities that we have. One of them is barriers to recruitment and hiring. And an example that the commission gives in the strategic enforcement plan is looking at these restrictive application processes. It gives an example of online systems that are inaccessible to individuals with disabilities. The reality is we have not received many charges at all alleging this type of discrimination, but, I mean, we are aware that applicants have run into this barrier, and it's very ironic because many times we think of technology as a boon for individuals with disabilities, but if it's inaccessible, it obviously is not. And there was a very well-publicized case decided in the Fourth Circuit last year called Reyazuddin versus Montgomery County, where Montgomery County, Maryland, upgraded its whole call center, countywide call center, a new 311 number that you would call. And even though they had a blind employee who used a screen reader in their then-existing call center, they failed to check with the vendor when they upgraded the technology for the new system as to whether it would be compatible with her screen reader. And it turned out that it wasn't, and it would have cost them $125,000 at least to go back and make it accessible after the fact. And the court rejected the county's argument that that would be an undue hardship, even though that's a large amount of money, looking at the, multi-million dollar budget of the call center and of the county, the billion-dollar budget of the county itself. So, it's expensive to make these mistakes. The employer is in the driver's seat when you're making these original selections. The vendor at that point will want to do everything for you, and you can insist on a demonstration. You can ask about other employers who've bought the same technology, so that you can contact them and find out what their experience is with accessibility. Do not simply accept some generic representation that it's 508 compliant. I think, Robin, you've probably also seen that slapped on products, and it doesn't necessarily tell the employer what you need to know about whether it will actually be accessible to your employees. If somebody were to, as I guess the questioner is saying, bring a challenge in and of itself to say that having an inaccessible online application system is a violation of the ADA. There's a number of different theories that have been bandied about over the years. I don't know of any case law on this. One theory is that the ADA requires that all the EEO laws require using neutral selection criteria, and that you can't use selection criteria that have the effect of disproportionately excluding people based on their protected status. And so even if it's unintentional, that this could be a violation of the ADA. Another theory is that you have to, you can't limit, segregate, or classify individuals with disabilities under the statute, and that you have to have methods of administration that don't have the effect of discriminating based on disability. These are just provisions in the statute. They just are, I would say, little used, and there hasn't been, there's no case law interpreting these provisions of the ADA or entertaining these, where these legal theories have been applied to inaccessible online application systems. So I guess given that landscape, where it's legally unclear if it's a violation of the ADA, where you encounter an inaccessible web-based application, the thing to do, of course, is to request reasonable accommodation. And, of course, someone could file a charge with the EEOC alleging that the system, the inaccessible system in and of itself violates the ADA, and we'd have to see how that would come out. But in addition, in terms of what else you can do, you could request accommodation. And I think the concern, Robin, that you said the questioner had was, if I request accommodation, a workaround by phoning the employer and saying I'm an applicant who can't use the online system, can I apply in a different way, that then you have self-identified. And I don't know that there is a way around that, because you do need to request accommodation. Now, of course, if the accommodation request is denied, or if the accommodation request is granted, but then the person isn't hired and they think it was because in retaliation for the accommodation request, then they should contact EEOC about filing a charge. And, you know, we would look at whether there was some discrimination after the fact, or, you know, in terms of the system itself, whether there was any viable undue hardship argument, just like we would with, you know, any other charge. So, I mean, it's certainly worth filing a charge and letting EEOC investigate as to an inaccessible system, a denial of accommodation for a workaround of an inaccessible system, or a non-hire in the wake of an accommodation request to work around an inaccessible hiring system. And then EEOC would look into whether or not there were defensible reasons for the employer's setup or the actions that they took. You know, it's possible, I suppose, what the questioner is really getting at as the risk that they take by self-identifying or by filing a charge. And, you know, that's a decision each person has to make in these circumstances about what they have to gain or lose by self-identifying and requesting accommodation. Robin, more on that from you?
Yep. Well, I mean, I can go on and on about it, because I think even the, you know, one can make a strong argument that, you know, even if the employer is going to offer me, let's say in the employee situation, that an alternative that you can meet with HR and, you know, review this stuff as an accommodation, that does not provide me the same flexibility of 24/7 that I can do when I'm, you know, have online access, privacy to access that information, you know, about my pay and things of that nature. I mean, I think there's a lot of arguments to be made that those
right. That it's not effective. Not effective. Right, and I think that would be the claim if someone were to challenge it.
Yeah.
There just is precious little case law one way or the other. Those kinds of claims haven't come to us or to the courts in any kind of large number.
Yeah, and I think it's because people feel that there's such a power imbalance there when I'm already an employee, and I, you know, risk losing my job and stuff because they're going to, you know, I just think that there's some problems there. But anyway, the follow-up, somebody online has asked, because you're in your comment about the vendor situation. Their question is to you, is the vendor claims the product is compliant and it turns out not to be, is that not fraud? And doesn't the employer then have a legal recourse for that?
I don't know. You know, that's really a question of contract law, not of ADA. But I have just heard from so many employers that they mistakenly trusted that representation of 508 compliant or ADA compliant, and it didn't turn out to be true, which is why I now for sure think that an employer should, as I said, ask to test it out, ask to talk to other employers who have used it for similar functions, whatever might be necessary to satisfy yourself or to have some provision in the contract that if it turns out not to be accessible, that you're going to be able to get your money back.
Yeah, agreed, definitely. I think buyer beware, right?
Right.
So, operator, could you please give some instructions for those on the phone as to how they can go about asking a question?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
And just a reminder that those online, you can always submit your question through the chat area. Online here, we have a few minutes left in regards to the questions that were asked in advance. Operator, is there anybody queuing in from the telephone?
There are no further questions at this time. Please continue.
Okay. So I have another question here that is, when requesting an accommodation, should an employee go to their supervisor or to HR, or is there a specific process they should be following?
Oh, well, that's very interesting. The ADA itself does not create a specific process. It's up to each employer if they choose to set out a process. Some employers have procedures. Some do not. If your employer has a procedure, you should follow it in terms of it might say to start with your supervisor. It might give you options to go to HR or a disability program manager who's been designated. But if you're in a situation where the workplace has no reasonable accommodation procedures or process, then go to whoever you feel most comfortable with or who you think is the most logical person. It might be your supervisor or someone in the chain of command. It might be HR. The most important thing is to follow up and make sure that you've, you know, if there's any documentation that's requested, that's, you know, that it's reasonable for the employer to ask that you provide, that you cooperate in that interactive process. On the flip side, I have seen a couple of cases where employers had a very specific process. It said, go to Joe in this office, and then the employee didn't go to Joe. They asked somebody, they asked a different manager. The employer did not act on the accommodation request, and the employer was faulted for that in the subsequent denial of accommodation claim brought under the ADA by the employee, with the court holding that at a minimum the employer should have directed the employee, provided that information about who to go to. There's a lot of ways that can be handled. Maybe the most secure for the employer in knowing that you don't overlook or drop any accommodation requests is if you have a particular process that your managers and supervisors and HR and all supervisory employees know that if they receive an accommodation request and they are not the one who is supposed to handle it, that they forward it to the appropriate person and advise the employee who they have sent it to as the appropriate person to handle it. That way, you're not risking that the ball gets dropped or that there's a different recounting of the situation later on with different recollections of who said what when. as between the employee and the person they asked. You really want to expedite those accommodation requests. You want to make sure they get to the person who's authorized to handle them. You don't want to, as I say, sort of stand on ceremony unnecessarily and risk that the request is not going to be acted on. Robin?
Thank you. Operator, were there anybody else who queued in at all during that period of time?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
Okay, I'm assuming that means there's nobody. Here's a question in relationship to employee benefits. Employers have initiated different types of programs, including incentives for engaging in exercise routines, wellness programs, et cetera. How does an employee with a disability who might be precluded from participation in some of those things due to their disability manage this issue with their employer?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of employers do have so-called wellness programs, and they provide incentives for either achieving certain health outcomes or simply participating in a wellness program. There are rules under the ADA that people are probably have heard about. If an employer wants to make you go to a medical exam as part of a wellness program or ask you medical questions, have you fill out a medical questionnaire, a health risk assessment, in those cases, rules under the ADA apply to make sure that your participation in the program is voluntary, because otherwise the employer would be requiring that you provide that medical information. And there are rules that EEOC issued on that issue under the ADA, and they have been disputed in court. There's been a recent ruling holding that they will be vacated as of parts of them as of January 2019, but they're still in effect for now. And on page 4 of my handout is a list under wellness programs of the publications we have on this, including a really simple small business fact sheet on employer wellness programs and a free webinar that you can link. The link is there under for the rules under the ADA on employer wellness programs. As to this specific question, you could request accommodation to be able to participate in the wellness program. So, Robin, I guess the way you posed the question is kind of general, but a specific example perhaps might be the employer provides a benefit or incentive for an employees who participate in a certain exercise program. And if somebody could not, because of their disability, participate in that specific type of exercise program, they could request accommodation, and the employer might be required to tailor it to a program that the individual could do within their medical restrictions and still be able to earn the benefit. So accommodation can be a feature of wellness programs, even though what everybody's heard about in the news is more that issue that I talked about first, about when employers can ask you for medical information as part of a wellness program. Accommodation can also be a feature so that folks can participate even if they have a disability. We would look at that the same way we do any accommodation request in terms of whether there's an undue hardship.
Great. Thank you. So we're at the bottom of the hour here, and one of the last questions, and I know that you gave some update in the beginning, but of course people are always wanting to know what might be coming in the pipeline or in the future. Is there any plans afoot for updating any of the current ADA guidance and with more maybe recent case law or anything of that nature, or any new technical assistance documents or materials than what you've already shared?
Okay, well, I can't comment on any specific plans, but in the handout, you'll see that a number of these technical assistance publications are just new in the past couple of years. I mentioned the one on PTSD and depression, the one on leave. So certainly if there are any issues that you encounter, portions of these publications that you wonder if it's still current or you have a question about current developments, you shouldn't hesitate to contact us. And my phone number and email is on the bio that Robin posted, but if you don't have access to that, my phone is 202-663-4693. 202-663-4693. The attorneys in my office take calls from employers and employees all the time. We can't bind the commission as to a particular case, but we're more than happy to try to direct you to the relevant and current information so that we can help you resolve whatever issue has come up.
Great. Thank you, Gina. I think people appreciate that, and we all know that there are constraints in that area. So at this time, I want to thank Jean for her time today and for being willing to answer all those questions. And to those of you who submitted questions in advance and to those that you submitted questions during the session, thank you very much. I just want to remind you keeping in the vein of Q&A here, we have our June 12th, and I do want to make note of the fact that this is different than our typical schedule. We normally have our sessions on the third Tuesday of every month. However, in June, on the third Tuesday, we will be, many of us across the country in the ADA National Network, and hopefully some of you will be at the ADA National Symposium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So we have moved our typical session in June up 1 week, and it will be held on June 12th. So still a Tuesday, same time, just 1 week earlier than we typically do that from our scheduling purposes. And we have invited the Department of Justice to join us for an open question and answer period. We are also taking questions in advance, similar to what we did today with the EEOC. So if you are registered and have not submitted a question in advance and have one, please go back to the website, log in, and under that session, you can add a question. Or you can also send us questions by email at webinars@adagreatlakes.org if you're interested in doing that as well. So, again, thank you very much for your participation today. Thank you, Jean, for joining us today and sharing so much great information with people. You will be receiving an email following today's session with an evaluation. We do value your input, so please take some time and give us your feedback, and we'll also contain information about how to get your certificates of attendance and the recording and things like that. So look for that email as a follow-up. So again, on behalf of the ADA National Network and the Great Lakes ADA Center, thank you, everyone, and have a great rest of your day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.